And welcome, everyone. Welcome to Real Asian Podcast. I am Ray, and I am joined today with Renee. What's up, Renee? How you doing?
Hey, the one and only. It's the Ray and Renee show.
It's been a while since both of us have been on an episode, just us two, right?
Yeah.
I think we've only done, or we did an origin story. We did
Donut King.
Donut King. Oh, I love that. I love that movie.
That
only because really of the donuts that were so good.
I know. It's been a little while.
It's been a while, but I am very excited to talk about this movie. We are talking about Saving Face, which is Alice Wu's first movie that she wrote and directed. Let me just kind of go over just what to expect in the episode. So I'm going to go over the synopsis of the movie just as a refresher. And then we're going to go through our big takeaway from the movie, our Love It and Leave It segment. We're going to talk about some of the themes of the movie. And we're also going to talk about some of our favorite scenes. Also, we're going to talk about LGBTQ films in the 2000s. I would like to kind of go over just the making of Saving Face. I think it's actually really interesting story. And then lastly, because we also did Alice Wu's other film on Netflix, we're going to compare which one we preferred, Saving Face or The Half of It. So you just have to tune in at the end.
That's so funny. Is that the reason why you chose me specifically? Because I'm like the only other host that actually...
You have experience in that. You have experience in that. So I feel like it was only right. It was only right.
Thank you.
Okay, let me go ahead and set the scene. So, Saving Face, written and directed by Alice Wu. It stars Michelle Kruzik, Joan Chen, and Lin Chen. Dr. Will Pang is a successful young American surgeon living in New York City. Will is a lesbian, but is closeted to her mother, Ma. Will is forced by her mother to come to a gathering at a restaurant, Planet China, with family friends, where her mother has plans to set her up with the son of a friend, but Will is actually drawn to Vivian, the daughter of one of the Chinese mothers who recently got divorced. They run into each other at the hospital where Will works, only to discover that Vivian's father is actually Will's boss, Dr. Xing. Will comes home to discover her mother has been kicked out by her grandfather for being pregnant out of wedlock. Mysteriously pregnant at that. Will asks for the identity of the father, but Ma refuses to answer, and at this point, no one knows who the father is. I feel like that's something that only Mari could figure out. He could determine who the father is.
The paternity test determined that you are not the father.
Oh my fucking God! And then they fucking jump out of the chair. It's like the most excited I would see men become like not the father of a child. Anyways. From then on, Ma lives with Will. Vivian invites Will to one of her dance shows, and after the show, the two hang out. Vivian reveals the fact that they had actually met once before when they were children. Vivian kissed Will on the nose after Will rescued her from her bullies. Will, though, ran away. Vivian and Will go to Vivian's apartment, and the two kiss. The couple goes on several dates, but Will is afraid of kissing Vivian in public. At Vivian's request, Will presents Vivian to her mother as a friend, quote-unquote, so that they can meet and the three share an awkward dinner. It is revealed later that her mother has an intuition of her homosexuality but is in denial. Set up by Will, Ma goes on several dates to find a man to be a father to her unborn child, but remains unattached. She debates on whether to accept the affections of Cho, a man who has loved her for 15 years and is willing to parent her child. Vivian reveals to Will that she was accepted into a prestigious ballet program in Paris and is considering the offer. Will congratulates Vivian and gives her encouragement to accept the offer. But while Vivian still debates on whether going or not, Vivian's father speaks to Will and presses her to persuade Vivian to accept the offer because he feels Will is the reason why she's reluctant. Will withdraws from Vivian and Vivian accepts the job in Paris. After Will's grandmother passes away unexpectedly, Ma accepts Cho's marriage proposal. At the wedding, Will interrupts with a love note from the father of the child saying how much he loves her and wants to marry her despite their age gap. Will, with a love note from the father of the child of Ma, Will points out the elderly pharmacist Old Yu as the man she believes is the father. Old Yu, though, denies the allegations and it's really Little Yu, his son.
That was such a reveal.
Classic Alice Wu at this point. Little Yu, his son, stands up and announces and professes that he is the father and he is madly in love with Ma. Will and her mother run out of the wedding and onto a bus, laughing. After an emotional talk with her mother, Will rushes to the airport to catch Vivian. and Will apologizes, but Vivian challenges Will to kiss her in public to prove her sincerity. Unable to do it publicly, Will is left at the terminal as Vivian leaves for Paris. 3 months later, Will goes to another party at Planet China where Ma and Little Yu are now a couple. Will sees Vivian, who has come home to see her mother, and Will approaches Vivian and asks her to dance. And they actually kiss in public, finally. The final scene shows Ma has Will and Vivian, family and friends, over at her apartment for a gathering. Ma asks Will about having babies, to which she reacts with a spit take. And then, scene. That's the end of the movie. So let's go into the big take, our biggest takeaway from the film. Renee, take it away.
So one thing I want to say about saving face is that the idea behind face can be described as some sort of combination of social standing, reputation, influence, your dignity and your honor. And causing someone to lose face lowers them in the eyes of their peers. There's many multiple levels of this, from, you know, Wai Gong, who's a professor, who has this daughter who's not a young daughter, right? A lot of times you see that the stereotype is a teenage daughter married out of, right, you know, pregnant out of wedlock. But this is the much older daughter who is pregnant out of wedlock. And then there's also much further down the line is Will, who is closeted and maybe a little bit ashamed of being a, you know, lesbian or bi, but definitely lesbian. There's this really gut-wrenching kind of line in there about how her mom feels like, I did not mess up, you are not gay, right? And ooh, then therefore her mom loses face too. Man, that gut-wrenching. And so there's this idea of losing face, or as Wai Gong says, throwing your face away.
Right.
Really, this movie is about coming full circle with the realization of being able to save face by raising, you know, your self-worth, but also to be able to kind of have a better outcome for everyone. So it was really interesting. My biggest takeaway from this entire film was about the complexities of each individual person has, from, you know, the old world to the new world. And even if you are an established, esteemed OR doctor, you can still cause shame to your family. And what does that mean for you as first or second generation Asian American? Is that something you still shoulder the burden? Is that something that you hold yourself back on because of the idea of potentially throwing your face away?
You know, something that you said that was just so interesting was this aspect where Will is kind of straddling two worlds, mm-hmm, in a way. On paper, Will has done everything that is probably stereotypically asked for. She's a doctor, for right, goodness sakes, right? Successful, takes care of her parents, exactly, and is close to her family, you know, has her own place. But she has this piece of her identity that she's so afraid of showing and admitting to her mom. But at the same time, her mom is also straddling both worlds, right? And even though her mom is doing everything as her dutiful daughter of the grandfather, she pursues her feelings for someone that she loves that is not conventional. That's such an age difference, and also has a baby out of wedlock, which is also perceived as shameful as well. But I want to go into our Love It and Leave It, so segment where we talk about one thing that we loved about the movie and one thing that we go ahead and leave.
Okay, perfect segue from talking about like the big take to my love it, because it really comes down to that complex mother-daughter relationship, not just with, you know, our Will, our protagonist, and her mom, but also Ma and Waipo, her mom, right? Grandma.
Ma. Oh, sorry, grandma.
Yeah, grandma, you know, and that's part of it is like, you know, there's these shades and nuances. And when her dad says to her, if I knew this was going to turn out this way, I would have left you in the old country. Mm. And that was like, oh, I cried so many. Okay, hold on. I have to ask you, Ray. Did you cry at all during this movie? Because I did.
No. I mean, there were definitely very emotional moments from the movie. But I think because the comedic pacing of it, it kept it light,
yeah,
in very timely moments. It sprinkled in the sad moments.
Really amazing beats. The actor Jin Wong, he did such an amazing job as Waigong, because he hit the nail on the head. You know, as the family patriarch, he just comes down really hard, but there is a softness to him that you can see as he loses his wife. Then he realizes he's all alone. All he has is his daughter at this point, and a community that's kind of shunned him because of this. His daughter has kind of shamed him a little bit. And so seeing the complexities between all of that, when they did the reveal of the mom with their prayer music going super duper loud, and she's like, "Mom, turn it down."
Like, and then turn it down, and then she turns it up.
Yeah, exactly. And then grandma's like, "Yeah, it's for because the baby," and she's like, "Pregnant." Oh my god, that was so hilarious. So I loved the fact that it was still really light, even though there was a lot of really deep, dark kind of beats in there as well. I mean, like, this is overall Saving Face is definitely top 10 movies for me. Like, Alice Wu nailed it.
Your leave it.
My leave it, I would definitely say, is it was interesting because she did add like an African American actor,
right, in her neighbor.
Yes, the neighbor. And what was really interesting about it was that there was, I was going to say there wasn't overt racism, but that's not true. It was overt racism, but in a different language. So, and that really recognize that, just talking shit about the other people because they can't understand you in your language. And so I was kind of like, I would say, even though I say leave the like microaggressions and the racism out, also at the same time, it kind of is an accurate representation.
It's pretty spot on. Unfortunately, I can speak from personal experience. Oh, it's pretty spot on.
Even the soy sauce comment.
I don't know if my parents have ever made a comment like that, but definitely, you know, comments about black skin.
Yeah, exactly. Their skin is colored as soy sauce. Oh, they're probably just dirty. You know, they don't wash themselves. Like, oh my god, that's the skin pigmentation. What are you talking about?
It's a very interesting thing to include in the movie. I'm trying to imagine if we didn't have that, you know, would that have taken away from the authenticity of the movie? Yeah, I guess you could say, you know. To be quite frank, I think when Alice was writing that, she had to pull from experience. And truth be told, she probably just heard those types of comments and that type of interaction between Asian communities and black communities, right, just from like an amalgamation from gossip talk,
right?
When and especially in a big city like New York City or San Francisco.
Oh my gosh, I know, right? Huge melting pot of all these different cultures. Actually, well, of that scene, of the scene where the neighbor comes and eats with him, can I just tell you my most offensive, that I'm most offended at, was actually that he touched his shoes with his hands and just threw it and then just started eating. And I was like, oh my god, wash your hands.
I think it was funny too. She was like, take off shoes. His shoes. Yeah, I mean, I also, you know, for our listeners too, it's not like that scene was in there and then all of us, like, she just said that and there was no point to it. You eventually do see Ma and the neighbor get close because he starts to become, they start to develop a relationship. They get to know each other. They start watching dramas together.
Right.
It's just that dinner scene is like the first interaction that she gets. And as Asian parents, as us Asian people, as you know, parents will say things that are just unfiltered. And you're like, oh my goodness.
Oh my God.
And here's the thing too. Movie came out 2005. And that scene now hits a lot different, obviously. Now we're a lot more aware. We're a lot more in tune with a lot more socially in tune. So clearly we point those things out.
Okay, Alan. I mean, sorry. Okay, Ray. I wish Alan was here, I guess. I know. Sorry about that. Okay, Ray. So what are your love it and leave it?
Okay, so my love it and leave it. Simply, I just love how this movie really resonated with me so much, especially on a personal level. As you may know, Renee, My sister is gay. I could never imagine what she had to go through when she was coming out to my mom. And how both my sister and my mom had to process that whole situation over the years. I know that from my own experience, it was a difficult time. Now, I won't go into the details of it all without my sister's consent. But to me, when she came out, I honestly just thought, okay. Like, it literally didn't change how I felt or how I saw my sister, my relationship with her, and all that. It, when she told me, I could tell that she was very trepidatious about it. She was very nervous, but I don't know. I mean, I think she was a little bit, I think I was the first person of the family because she probably felt the most comfortable. I hope, maybe. But my reaction was literally just like, thank you for telling me, but that doesn't change anything about you. You know how I see you. Right. Like, I mean, if anything, it's like, I'm always going to love you for, no matter what.
Aww.
And I think that's why I love this movie, right? While this movie is touted as an important movie for the LGBTQ plus IA community, you know, Will being a lesbian wasn't the focus of the movie. It's a very important part of it, obviously, with Vivian being the love interest. But I saw the movie as the focus of the movie was really the relationship between Will and her mom and the mother and daughter bond. And Will coming out to her mom was a challenge that both was a test in their relationship. And so I think that's really why I love the movie. It was written well. It was very it was acted well, and it was just very heartwarming. So that's my biggest thing of why I love the movie.
I think that's really sweet. I think that's absolutely, like, I think that's like probably the best case scenario when someone comes out to you, is that you basically are like, all right, pass the rice, you know, like you're just basically like next thing. And
yeah, just stoic.
Just
yeah.
Keep going. Yeah. And yeah. Okay. Leave it.
My leave it. I will not allow this movie to slander the name Raymond, okay? So I was slightly hurt that in one of my favorite movies of all time, the one character named Raymond is a fucking finance bro. I'm not denying they don't exist. I'm sure there's plenty of finance bros out there named Raymond. I just have to assume Alice Wu probably based that character from experience. She probably ran into a Raymond who was a freaking finance bro. But you know what? I'm here to represent the good Raymonds out there in the world, okay?
Okay. Wait, okay. Did you just come out and say that this is one of your favorite films of all time?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Wow.
Except for that one part. Except for, if I could change anything about the film, let's not make the one guy who's like talking about stocks and I don't know, he's talking about Verizon and stuff like that. His name is Raymond. I was like, oh no.
I mean, it should have been something more, you know, I don't know, like Edwin or something maybe.
Yeah.
Is this like the equivalent of saying like, oh, you're such a Karen. So you're such a Raymond.
Yeah, I know. I wonder, like, Karen, as hilarious as that term is and what it means, I just feel bad for all Karens out there.
That's right. So here you go. You just feel bad for all Raymonds because they're all like douchey finance bros.
Finance bros. Oh, man. Okay. Let's go over some of the themes of the movie. I mean, there's plenty of themes to pull apart. You know, we talked about challenging tradition and how Will and Ma are essentially these agents of testing the boundaries of within their culture in their generation too. So we're talking about intergenerational traditions and the trauma that kind of comes along with it. Speak about some of the things that you picked out, Renee, about tradition, conventional thought, challenging some of that, and what this movie really was asking or proposing when it comes to those themes.
So I think one of the biggest challenging of traditions, I would say, is, well, first off, obviously, just Will's existence because she's a lesbian, she's gay. Like, that in itself is challenging traditions because, you know, the whole idea is that most people are cishet and enter into those kind of like relationships. But here, Will is just existing. And basically, you know, what I'm segueing into is the perfect daughter kind of a tradition. So I being needing to be a perfect daughter.
I was just gonna ask you, like, do you ever feel that pressure?
Always.
And also, as a mom, do you feel like you're carrying that also?
So as a daughter, I would definitely say like there was some like unspoken expectations of me, and then there were some like actual really obvious expectations of me. So there was always this weight on my shoulders of having to carry the family name and then having to be really successful. And that's kind of why I finished high school when I was 15 and got my undergrad when I was 17. You know,
like damn.
Doing thanks. Doing all these things so that I can Doogie make my Howser over proud. Here. Well, because one of the fastest ways to change your status and when you're first generation, like, you know, is to become a doctor. And so there was this expectation from my parents that I was going to make them proud and become a doctor. And so when I said, F that, I'm going to the video game industry, they weren't the most happy about that.
It's like, what? You're going to rot your brain.
But I've turned that into this, you know, 17 plus year career, and it does not make them happy, but it makes me happy. And I think that's one of the biggest things about challenging tradition is like, while Will, what did become a doctor, she still had this role of not being able to be the perfect daughter, right? Because her mom felt she failed as a parent because her daughter came out gay. And it's like, why is that the case, right? There's some internalized issues there. And so, but also on the mom's side, right? Ma married some other dude, the first, you know, her first husband, because that's what her dad needed her to do. And then the second marriage that she was going to go into, again, yet again, it was because this person who would be able to enter her family into this prestige, and he would take care of her kid and stuff like that. And like, she needed to really step up. Like, okay, at this point, what, she's like 48 or something like that? She's getting much older. Does she still need to live her life for her parents, her community? Or could she finally own that agency and be able to live her life for herself? And I think for me, it took me a really long time to get to that point. I was like 28, 29, whereas I have a lot of other friends and family who learned that much earlier on.
I love how this film really challenges the conventional thoughts and traditions often held by Chinese culture. And I think it's okay to criticize certain aspects of traditional Chinese culture. Very important. I love Chinese culture, but there are aspects of it that even when I was growing up, I questioned a lot. Even on just behalf of my sister and just some of the things that my parents were trying to impart on me, you know, things such as needing, and this is illustrated, I think it was Cho who was dancing with Will in the beginning of the movie where he said something where it's like, you leave a meat out on the grill too long, it'll dry out. Like, and he was referring to like a single woman.
Right.
Like, oh my God.
I was like, oh my God. I was like, that's God.
The worst thing that she could put. And then I think after that, he's like, oh, I'm interested in your mom, by the way. It's like, well, thanks.
Yeah. He's like,
I was like, oh, that's great that you're interested in my mom after saying that horrible thing. But also this aspect of, you know, women need to be married. It's like all of a sudden they have no value in society if they're unmarried. And if they are married, they should be married to a man that's successful and wealth and all this stuff. So Alice Wu acknowledges these ideas and she puts them in the movie. And Will is essentially the avatar of testing the waters a bit, you know, questioning just her existence, as you said, Renee, and her character, asking the question, like, do we really have to follow these rules in order to be happy? Clearly, in the journey of the movie, it's like, no. But even then, I think the process of figuring that out, because anytime a person disagrees with a tribe or their culture that they were brought up in, it's a very challenging and difficult thing, because now you feel like you're leaving that said tribe that you're a part of and you're being ostracized in a while. And then so you have that second guessing, like, am I really, you know, am I doing the right thing? Am I correct in feeling this way, or should I just shut up and continue doing what is told of me or expected of me, you know?
That's actually a really interesting observation, Ray. I'd love to know, like, for you, personally, do you feel like you had a lot of expectations traditionally wise for you, like as like the son of the family, things like that?
You know, to be honest, as a son, I don't think so. I think I had a lot of leeway.
Yeah. Because your sister paved the way for you.
Because my sister paved the way and she took a lot of the pressure being the oldest one. You know, her going to a good 4-year college. You know, she went to USC and kind of going off and doing her own thing. That was the expectation of me as well. But it took a while for me to finish college. And it was simply because I just didn't know what I wanted to do. Yeah, there were certainly moments where my mom and my dad were like, what are you doing with your life kind of thing? And you should be doing something with your life and just get a college degree. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do because I was trying to figure out the motivation or a direction of what I wanted to do in life. But I did feel the pressure because it wasn't like our family was well off. I think early on, definitely making sure to get good grades and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I think over time, my mom became a lot more lax.
Yeah.
As long as you're a good person.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah.
That's nice.
But there were certain, there was certain things like when I wanted to get my ears pierced, my mom didn't like that because she thought that that would prevent me from getting a job.
Oh, I see. Not that you were a gangster or something.
Well, that too. Yeah. Oh, okay. She thought she was like, that's what gangsters do. And then I remember too, after my sister came out and when I wanted to get my ears pierced, I got one ear pierced and I got my other ear pierced and later on. She was like, why do you want to get both ears pierced? And I told her it's because I'm gay.
No.
And I was like, I'm just kidding, mom. I'm just kidding.
Oh my God.
I was like, she's like, that's not funny. Oh.
And this is after your sister came.
Yeah. And oh I was like, I'm sorry, mom. I couldn't. It was too easy. I couldn't pass that up. And then also same thing when I got my tattoos, she thought the same thing. She was like, you're not going to get a job. People are going to look at you as a bad person and you're people think you're part of a gang and all that stuff. But over time,
how old are you at this point?
I got my first tattoo, I think at 19.
And she was little like, oh, you're not going to get a job at 19. Okay.
Yeah.
It's the Bay Area too, first off. Like, you'll be fine.
But you know, I mean, I think it was that whole aspect of them like wanting to assimilate, be good, good Americans and all that stuff.
Oh my gosh, right.
But let's talk about, we talked about a lot about Will and her mom. I want you to kind of share with me the bond between a mother and daughter, because despite their differences in perspectives and beliefs, you know, as I mentioned before, their bond is really tested throughout the movie. And in the end, it really does show, regardless of the situation they are in and what they experience, they have really unconditional love for each other, right?
Right. It's actually one of my favorite quotes, but it's not the favorite quote, so I'm still saving my favorite quote, is actually from when Will and her colleague are talking. She's like, do you understand the karmic hell I would have to pay if I didn't take my mom in?
Yeah. Right.
So there's like, there is this unconditional love, but there's also like guilt tied into it. And so what's really interesting is to be able to kind of see, like, Will's mom knows she's not perfect. She knows that she's made mistakes, but that doesn't preclude her from not being able to still tell her daughter what she needs to do in her life and how to do it. Like when she's cleaning out the fridge and things like that. Right. Like, and that's like such a small thing. So it was really interesting for me actually to see that her mom was more detrimental to her about cleaning up her house than when she came out as gay to her mom. Her mom just kind of like didn't want to look at her, didn't want to acknowledge her, just
didn't even acknowledge it.
Right. It just like swept it under the rug versus like picking up after herself. You need to do this, you need to do that, your friend needs to do this, stuff like that, right? It was really interesting to kind of see. And, you know, for me personally, I know that like I have a really conflicted, bad relationship with my parents. Mm-hmm. The karmic hell, my mom was like needing to work in the Bay Area and she asked if she could stay with me. And I was like, no, you know, and that was like really hard for me to do. But a part
it's understandable.
It was like
I could not live with my mom.
No,
sure.
I couldn't. I just can't. And I just
you
know, like I had such a bad relationship with her already, and then her asking me to do this, you know, I just like, oh my God. But it didn't mean that I didn't love her still. And I would say like even that still is the case. Like I'm still like at that point. Like, would I take care of my parents? You know, knowing how they would treat me and things like that. And I think that's just kind of part of it. Like there is this unspoken mother-daughter bond between Will and Ma. And it just kind of shows like when they're running away, that The Graduate is actually kind of like a really good homage to it. When they're running away from the church scene and together into the bus and just like still like, okay, well, what am I going to do now? Okay, I'll move back in with you. Yeah, yeah. And it's just like, you know, like she just wants to be like friends again. And, you know, Will's like, no, I have to put my foot down. Like, you need to grow up, right? So that was really interesting to see from the very beginning of that karmic hell that she'd have to pay to, no, mom, I'm putting boundaries up because I love you. Like, you know?
And the part where Will is setting or dressing up her ma and they're preparing her for her date. And there's that part where she looks at her and she's like, you're beautiful.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, it's so sweet. Because that's how she truly sees her mom. And I mean, first of all, Joan Chen is beautiful, though.
Yes, she is gorgeous.
Yeah, it's a beautiful bond that they have. And it's the flaws between them that they both share is what bonds them together in the end, you know?
One thing that I want to put the point a little bit further. Her mom just sees her homosexuality as something of inherent badness. Not that she is disappointed or things like that, just it's bad, right? It's not like you're, you know, and that actually, similarly, Alice Wu brings that back in her second follow-up film to it, like the half of it, where basically the same thing happens when, you know, oh my God, I can't remember any of the names anymore. When she comes out to her friend and he's all like, oh my God, you know, that's a sin.
Oh,
right?
Paul.
He was Paul. Yeah, Paul, right? Like, he's like, that's a sin, you know? And it was just like, it wasn't like, he was like, you're going to hell. It was just like, you're my friend. And now I you know, you're going to be punished forever because of this, right?
Because it's what was taught of him.
Yeah. Exactly. And so the same thing you see that with Ma here is that she has that same thing. It was just like, I was taught that you're supposed to a man and a woman. And so, you know, I did not fail as a parent because you were not with a man.
I want to talk a little bit about that, this aspect of shame. You know, growing up, it was so ingrained in me. And we talked about the expectations and pressures of being a first generation born Chinese American, Vietnamese Chinese American of myself. I always felt like when I was growing up, it was to avoid any situation that would bring about shame to my family. And I still think about it to this day, right? It was almost like a death sentence to disappoint my parents or grandparents, just my family members. It could be something as trivial as bad or mediocre grades on a test. Like, I could never share that and never wanted to share that with my parents because they would just kind of, you know, be disappointed. And I just didn't want to feel that level of shame.
Dishonor,
you know,
and to your family.
Dishonor to the name, you know, and even the fact of like, oh, and it comes about when they compare children. It's like, oh, I know. My child is an actor. Then they go to another friend of theirs and go, oh, my child is a doctor. And they go, oh, that's cute. Your child is an actor. My child makes a lot of money as a doctor and all that stuff. So shame plays a big part of it. You know, we know filial piety is a key component of Asian culture, respecting one's parents and their wishes. But really the cost of that is, you know, when you are unable to achieve their wishes and expectations, shame becomes a byproduct of that. And I think it's just something that is really illustrated perfectly in this movie. And that really, shame is what really prevents Will from wanting to be public about her homosexuality. And it's not even just with her family, but it's even with Vivian, right? She's at alone in a park. No one around that she knows, but she still can't kiss her, you know, kiss this person that she loves in public.
You brought up such a really good point about that and about how it's tied to the family, right? The lineage, the heritage, where that comes from, all the centuries of people that came before you. I was reading this Facebook or Instagram post or something, and I was trying to find it while you were talking. But I can't. But basically what it said was something along the lines of like, we use family shame as a way to hold us back from the things that we really want to be able to do. Because part of it is, what if you fail at it? But what if you succeed? Like, so why hold yourself back because you think you're going to shame your family in this amorphous, ephemeral shame thing? Versus doing something that you love and removing the shackles that bind you. This is my words, not the anymore. But
it was really good. I believed it. It could have been the whole IG post. I was like, damn, you need to share that.
Yeah. Snaps. But it was just
shackles.
Like,
nice.
Yeah. But it is. It really is. It's like this burden on you. And I always felt like I was carrying this like ton of bricks, this house of bricks on my shoulders of like, of that, of not wanting to disappoint or shame or whatever. And so whenever I would have a hobby or something I really loved, like I really loved playing the viola. But my parents are like, well, you're not very good at it. So you know, why keep going? You just fail. What are you going to do with that? You know, I was like, oh my God, you know, it's just like, but then
thanks for the encouragement.
I know. Right. But instead of like taking that and just being like, okay, well, that's your opinion. I'm just going to keep on doing me. Like it took me a while to break through that and realize that part of it was like, they were just like making sure, like, do you even care about this? Like, but in their own way, they were trying to encourage me. But it was like, this is not encouragement, you know?
Yeah, it's a weird way of encouragement. It's like, I want to encourage them. You suck.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for encouraging me, I guess.
So do you feel like you taking some, like an extended time to graduate from college, do you feel like that was a little bit part of like the shame because you didn't know exactly what you were going to do and them coming in like, you need to do something with your life. Like, did that compound it or
yeah, you were just like, the funny thing is like looking back on it, it wasn't like every time I saw my mom or my dad, it was like, did you graduate college yet? You know, kind of thing.
Oh, it wasn't.
It was, no.
How nice of them.
I know. But it was one of those things where I knew when it came to having conversations of what are you up to kind of thing, or what are you doing? How are things? I just believe that it was in the back of their mind.
Yeah.
And the only reason why they weren't saying it is because they knew I would have been peeved about it.
Yeah.
Whether that's true or not, that could have just been a self-reflection of what I was really thinking, which was like, I felt shame that I hadn't graduated college yet. And also not just from family, but just comparisons from other friends. Right. I had friends who are graduating a lot sooner than me. And even if I never graduated college, that doesn't necessarily, you know, validate my worth in society in a way. I mean, I would just be like, I would be damn sure I would be doing something that I love and is productive. Luckily, I didn't get it all the way, but it was definitely self-inflicted. Do you still feel a level of that burden as a parent now, like even to your kids?
You know, it's interesting because as a parent and knowing what my kind of like expectations, some of it was just projections of my own like insecurities. A little bit of it is like, you know, my daughters are, they're not like full Hmong. They're like, they're Hmong and they're Anglo white. And so there's both like this level of like, oh, they don't have as much expectations on them because, you know, the community doesn't really see them as full Hmong anyway. But then there's also the duality of, but do they feel like they even have any ties to that community? So part of it is I am really ingrained in the community. I'm very lucky. So I do have them as part of it and I'm pulling them in. And so whether or not they feel like they're a part of it, by just proxy of being near me, they are. But also at the same time, you know, they're still fairly young, but there's that aspect of like, do they feel like they belong? And I think that's the concern that I have, that yeah, I can't protect them from that aspect of it.
Like the challenges that you can anticipate that they will run into from...
Because I ran into them as like, you know, they called me whitewashed Hmong person because I was born
right
here.
And you're full Hmong too.
Yeah, exactly. So. Exactly. So they're not. And I, yeah, so, you know, I'm not going to be able to protect them from that aspect of it. All I can do is just try to like help give them tools, which my parents did not have. So, you know, they didn't have that issue. If anything, it was just about survival. And so now it's just different complex societal things that are on a totally different level. Because when you're not no longer just surviving, then there's nuance to thriving.
And, you know, I would hope, this is me looking at the glass half full, would hope that in the future we get to a point where your daughters, being biracial, live in a world where they don't have to deal with that as much. I mean, I'm assuming that we'll probably run into certain things about it, but I have to imagine people who are doing the work today will make it a lot better for people, for kids in the future. You know, people who are doing the work like our friend Ryan Alexander Holmes,
yeah,
and who are really bringing up those discussions that says, yes, I'm biracial, but I am culturally both of my cultures. Like, right, I'm 100% right. Black, I'm 100% Chinese, as he says. And it's true. It's like, just because you're biracial, I mean, you just have two cultures.
Right, yeah. That's actually really interesting that you say that, because they got it easy in comparison because they're Wajin. You know, if they were Blasian, it definitely would be a lot harder. Yeah. So, you know, I think that's one of the things is like, it's like, again, I said, it's like nuances, right? Like even as a multiracial kind of person, like they aren't necessarily invited into all spaces, right? I wouldn't want them coming in as a Wajin into a Blasian space and being like, oh yeah, I'm suffering too. And it's like, dude, yes, you sure. know, like, yeah.
Like, wait a minute.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Sure.
But you're not going to get stopped, you know, because of the color of your skin. You know, you can still pass. You know, like, that's definitely it. And as my daughters grow, you know, my youngest is going to be 9 on Valentine's Day. And my oldest will be 13. And my oldest would be 13. Like, they're still in a place of society where they're still really buffeted from any of the kind of issues that they would even need to contend with at this point.
Let's go through our favorite scenes in the movie. I know, Renee, you have a few favorite scenes. Go ahead and share them with me. I'm sure we share a lot of favorite scenes, and let's just talk about them, because there was plenty of,
oh my gosh,
definitely rewatchable scenes through this movie.
It was a smorgasbord, a buffet, if you will, of filled with, you know, a lazy Susan filled with lots of dim sum of delicious scenes. And I will have to say my favorite one definitely was when it jump cuts from when Grandma told Will that her mom is pregnant, and it jump cuts to the table scene of all the gossiping aunties and uncles.
Of course.
It was just so good because it was like, pregnant at her age, it's a scandal. It's a disgrace. It's better than the soaps. More drama, more intrigue. And then the uncle, more eel. And it was like, oh my God.
It's like, of course the guy's not paying attention.
Exactly. The guy's like, do not give a shit. They're like, but the aunties obviously want to go ahead and just like talk shit. So, you know, I really liked that. That was probably like a really good scene, like a tone setter for the rest of the film, mm-hmm. even though there were dark points. And like, because then right after that scene, it jumps back to, you know, them at their dad's house, and they're like, oh, your grandma, and, you know, grandma's saying like, oh, you know, grandpa's going to you know, like, kick her out of Flushing's. And like, you can't do that, like, where's she gonna go? And, you know, so I just thought it was like, there was definitely these really well nested, just like dark high scenes, dark scenes, high scenes, dark scenes. And there was just like, I loved it all. But that was my favorite one. How about you, Ray? What's your favorite scene?
I would say the scene where Ma is going to the video the rental place. Like, it's cool too. It's like a nice little Easter egg where you see like the Joy Luck Club.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Child.
The Asian. Yeah, exactly. Asian, yeah. Section.
And it's like this funny moment where it's like, oh, these are milestones in Asian American cinema and all that stuff. But, and then she actually ends up, she's like, oh, wait a minute, this is porn that she fits up. And then so the scenes of where she's watching porn, yeah, her face is just so surprised. I can't tell. It's like, you can't tell if she's like shocked at what she's seeing or maybe aroused at what she's seeing.
Like, this is way before RedTube, way before OnlyFans, you know, like there is no internet to be had.
You had to do it the old school way. Exactly. You had to go to the store. And if we're talking about shame, yeah, going into the store, you're like, oh, man.
Putting that across the counter and saying, this is the one I want.
But before, I remember it would always be behind the curtains.
Yes.
It's like the adult section when I would go into Blockbuster. And you're like, what's behind there? But also in that scene, the funny thing is right before the scene changes, you hear from the movie, who's your Asian daddy?
No.
Oh, man. That was really great.
Oh man, I think one of the other favorite scenes of mine actually is, it's a comedy one too, where Will and Vivian are in bed and the tape or the answering machine. Okay, answering machine,
yeah,
guys.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe these Gen Zers listening will not know what an answering machine is, but it starts going, and it's her mom's like, oh, I think she's there, and gets really frustrated. And then Will's like, you talk to your mom about it? Does she know we have sex? Oh my God.
Just like, as they're getting it on.
Yeah, that was really funny. I liked that part too.
You know, I like the ending, and I know some people knock on the ending, like the wedding scene.
Yeah.
I felt that it gave charm that is honestly the reason why I love rom-coms.
Yeah.
It had to have that rom-com ending kind of resolution. I mean, which is so typical. And yeah, the feel-good solutions and you know, reconciliations came quite rapidly in the end. And that was like the knock on it. It was like, oh, all of a sudden everything is just like fixed in one scene kind of in
it's
a way.
It's like 3 months later, guys. Bruh.
Yeah, exactly.
Time's passed.
But I thought it perfectly captured like the New York minute where you get this rush of energy that makes you feel alive. And I enjoyed it. I don't know why people gave it such grief about it. And I was like, no, it was good. I liked the ending.
You know, if I have to rate that scene to like the reveal scene in the last rom-com we talked about, which was Love Hard, I will have to say the Alice Wu's formula of, you know, that pinnacle part of the film, it's chef kiss good, because even in her sophomore film after that, the half of it, it's similar setup, but it is such a good payoff. I don't know. I think it's fine. I liked it.
Annie's Tea Cakes is an Oakland-based food company on a mission to provide plant-based Chinese food options to the world. As a longtime plant-based eater, Annie started this business to create a way for herself and others to enjoy the foods often shared with family but don't fit a plant-based diet. The journey started with vegan Taiwanese pineapple cakes. Follow Annie's Tea Cakes on Instagram or go to annie'steacakes.com to place your order today.
Let's go ahead and mention some of the LGBTQ movies in the 2000s. You know, this movie came out 2005, ahead of its time.
Oh, absolutely.
And I just felt like, I wonder what the genre was kind of up against when it was coming out in the 2000s, right?
Exactly. Well, one of the notable films that actually came out around the same time and had wide theatrical release, but it featured two leading men in Brokeback Mountain, and this was in 2005. You know, that was definitely more controversial and was like, you know, a tastemaker moment for our society, you know. And so I definitely would say like that was what was it coming up against. And I think that the Asian representation kind of the LGBTQIA kind of films at that time, it definitely was a little bit more depressed in comparison to the notoriety of Brokeback Mountain.
Scarce too.
Yeah, because also at the same time, so here's the thing. Yes, Jake Gyllenhaal. The second thing though was Heath Ledger, and then he died very soon after.
Rest in peace.
And I think those two combined made it this like milestone moment for LGBT films.
You know, I remember Brokeback Mountain being such a huge moment in pop culture, you know, because I think because also of the actors involved, the star power that it had, Jake Gyllenhaal, Heath Ledger, you know, these were like it actors at the time.
Yes.
And for them to be in a movie like this, a lot of people were just caught off guard, like, what? And then the setting and the context of the movie, them being two American cowboys, which right. is like in movies, like the manliest thing that you could be on screen,
exactly.
right? And it was directed by Ang Lee, right? And so you had Ang Lee, I think he directed Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon before that too. And for him to kind of take on this project, obviously, was a huge milestone in that too. And it just showed, doesn't matter who you are, if you have a good sense of the story and the direction you want to go, it'll turn out to be a good commercial success. And I think the fact that it was a huge commercial success was such a pivot point for the LGBTQ community, especially on screen.
That's really interesting, because I definitely want to also bring up in regards to cinema, you know, there were two films in the 90s that really come to mind that crawled so that these later LGBT films could run, walk and run, right?
Yeah.
And so the two films in the 90s that come to mind is The Birdcage with Robin Williams and Nathan Lane. And then this other one is Tu Wong Fu with Love. And that has John Leguizamo and Wesley Snipes, and you know, like, and
how '90s can you get?
I know. So those two films were really, I think, pivotal in just like introducing LGBT examples into mainstream media, and then you go into having the introduction of in the early aughts, you know, Brokeback Mountain, Milk, Alice Wu's Saving Face, and then fast forward and you start to see these LGBT kind of movies really start to become award worthy, you know, where you have things like Call Me By Your Name with Timothée Chalamet, right? Blue is the Warmest Color, Moonlight, and where Moonlight then is even taking on to form of like being able to be Black and gay, mm-hmm. right? And it's like,
yep, pushing the boundaries every so often.
Yeah, yeah.
Another movie I want to mention is not a well-known movie, but there's a movie called Kissing Jessica Stein. The movie itself was actually all right, but mainly because I love the soundtrack, and I actually listen to the soundtrack to this day. It's like a very jazzy soundtrack. I just want to throw that in there.
Nice.
My sister actually got me on it, and I was like, oh, this is an amazing soundtrack. And also another one of a real classic one that I've heard all time and time again was Hedwig and the Angry Inch. That has like its own cult following.
Yeah,
kind of big cult following.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so I want to just go over quickly in terms of the production and the development of this movie of Saving Face, because I think it's important. I think it's a parable of, honestly, what happens when you can't deny your talent and your passion and your conviction to just do something. And I'm talking about with Alice Wu, right? And so Alice was working at Microsoft at the time, and she was writing her novel. Saving Face was actually hashed out in 3 nights before she had to submit the script for this competition. And amazingly, for this like little competition that she did in class, and amazingly, her instructor liked it, she said. Her instructor was the one who told Alice she should protect the integrity of the script only if she was directing it herself. Good on the instructor for really setting the tone right then and there.
Okay, Alice Wu coming out as an overachiever.
I know, so right? Asian. And of course, early interested producers wanted to change the heart of her script. They said things like, couldn't her characters be white? Maybe the young doctor could be played by Reese Witherspoon.
Oh my God. I'm just facepalming over here, guys.
I know. And then how about making the love affair heterosexual? Did she have to direct it as well? You know, these are the things that were asked of her.
Was it Harvey Weinstein asking her these awful questions?
Possibly.
Oh my God.
But luckily, she ran into a Mr. Teddy Z. So Teddy Z was the president of Overbrook Entertainment or Production, which was Will Smith's production company. And so when she met Mr. Z, you know, he got a chance to look at the script, and Mr. Z said that it was an awakening for him because of the Asian American experience that he had experienced in Hollywood. In the studio system, every day he said, there are actors coming in who are Chinese Americans who don't get an opportunity to play different parts except to play prostitutes or waiters. And so when he read this script, he was like, wow, this is such a change of pace, right? But even then, Mr. Z had some suggestions or recommendation or notes to Alice. He said he asked her to consider changing the ballerina's ethnicity. He thought the love interest should be white so that they could cast a star. Alice said, no.
We're done.
Because...
Shut it down.
Because, and this is, again, having the foresight. She said, the moment you make the love interest white, it becomes about race.
Yep.
Another interesting thing about the making of the film, as it happened, because they were on a pretty tight budget. I think they only had like $2.5 million to make the movie. It was made around the same time Hitch was made, which is Will Smith's rom-com, which I love. I love Hitch. So there's a story where she says that in the movie Hitch, there's a lot of aerial shots. So they're on this helicopter. And so Mr. Z arranged to have Saving Face have a shadow unit pile into the cabin of the helicopter for a sharply reduced fee. So while Hitch was recording their views of New York City, Alice was also getting her aerial shots for Saving Face. So like the two shots that you get, they should be very similar.
Yeah, they're definitely real scrappy. They're like, okay, we gotta be innovative here. Just gotta go for it.
And then so ultimately the movie premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival on September 12, 2004, and it kind of made its way around the independent film circuit. It initially opened up at 6 theaters, making $75,000 in its opening weekend. But here's the thing. It was opening up against The Longest Yard, which was starring Adam Sandler and Burt Reynolds. And it also opened up against Madagascar, which was a big movie at the time. And it also opened up against Star Wars Episode 3.
Well, it's Star Wars.
But here's the thing. I think it says a lot that the actors come together for a reunion every so often because it was that important of a movie for them. And that really watching it today, it still holds up. And so having a movie like that, I think, is like the best thing that you can really have as a filmmaker, I believe.
Just like that family bond and things like that. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, almost every single person from that film actually went off to have very successful careers in the industry as writers and producers and directors and, of course, as actors.
Okay, so as we mentioned before, and we're going to close this out, Alice's sophomore film was The Half of It on Netflix. We did an episode on that. Go check it out.
Season one.
I wanted to ask you, Renee, between Saving Face and The Half of It, which one do you prefer?
Oh my God. It's interesting because like both of them are amazing pieces of work. And you can see like just like the level up that happens between the different films. And they're also like 15 years apart.
Yeah.
I would say that maybe if I was a teenager or like 20s, it would probably be The Half of It. It is so well written. It is so smart. It is biting. It is good. There's these really wonderful scenes that are just works of art on its own. But I will have to say, like, I think Saving Face is probably a little bit closer to, you know, it is a top 10. And I would say Half of It is up there too. You know, if I have to choose, Ray, I hate you. It would be probably Saving Face by a sliver.
I think both films are great films as well, but I'm going to have to give the edge to Saving Face. I thought the writing was better and the comedy was a bit more clever and better timed. And obviously I have a personal resonance with Saving Face, as I explained earlier, which plays into it too, to be honest. Also, you know, in terms of trios, right, and this is, again, becoming a signature part of Alice Wu's writing and filmmaking, having like a triangle aspect of it. While Ellie, Paul, and Aster have a unique twist, or that whole trio is a unique twist of your typical love triangle, right? It's a twist on the Serrano de Bergerac storyline. I think Will, her mom, and Vivian have a very different love triangle, but It's a triangle that is founded on like purity, sincerity, unconditional love. And honestly, it just seems unbreakable. And I felt like that resonated with me a lot more with Saving Face. Again, two pretty good films. I'm not saying Half of It is bad, or I'm not saying Alice Wu dropped off a little bit when she made The Half of It. I'm just saying Desert Island. If I had to take one movie between the two, I would take Saving Face.
Here is a little Easter egg. Did you know in Half of It, the mom picture is actually Joan from Saving Face?
That's awesome. Little Easter egg.
Yeah, nice little Easter egg there.
Well, Renee, thank you very much again for jumping onto this pod with me. That's going to conclude today's episode of Real Asian Podcasts. Tune in next time for another episode, and we'll catch you on the flip side. Who's your Asian daddy?
Bye.